Well, good evening to you all, and welcome to the Clash Lecture Series. My name is Paul Schultz, and I'm one of the pastors here at Hill Country Bible, and we want to welcome you, especially if this is your first time. We are really glad you're here. We consider you a special guest. We also want to welcome our campuses out at Steiner Ranch and at Brushy Creek. You guys are joining us by live feed, and so we have an audience that's not even here in the room with us. We're really glad that those guys are here also. Well, part of the goal here is to generate discussion about myths that surround Christianity. Pastor Tim Hawks is going to be leading our lecture tonight. And I want to just tell you a couple of things about what you can expect. Pastor Tim is going to lecture for about 45 minutes tonight. And after that, there's going to be a 30-minute, maybe 20 to 30-minute question and answer period where you can actually text in your questions. I think that information is going to be right here. So you can text in your right there to 512 and you can read that. And we want to encourage you, when this is over, that this doesn't end, that you can stay as long as you like to have conversations, to go down and have coffee, either down here in our lobby or out at the campuses. There's going to be opportunities to do that and extend this conversation. Well, the Clash is brought to you guys tonight by the Saturate Austin Lecture Series, by the Saturate Austin Institute. Saturate Austin is a new initiative by Hill Country Bible Church to provide education, equipping, and training for those of you who maybe serve in lay ministry and want to be better equipped, those of you who want to make a bigger impact in your marketplace, and also for those of you who may be considering vocational ministry or church planning or missionary work. In fact, watch this video about Saturate Austin.
Hardwired into every human being is a desire to leave a mark on the world. Each and every one of us wants to know that our lives made a difference, that we have an impact that will last long after we're gone. Where are you investing your life? What kind of impact will you have on your family and neighbors, on the people you work with, on the world? God wants to touch every man, woman, and child with His love and grace. Are you available and prepared for Him to use you? We are excited to share that this fall, Hill Country Bible Church will launch a new initiative called Saturate Austin. The vision and purpose of Saturate Austin is to prepare every person to be an active and effective part of God's plan for Greater Austin. If you want to become a better leader, Saturate Austin will equip you to be a part of what God is already doing in our great city. Saturate Austin will kick off this fall with the Saturate Austin Institute. The Institute is for anyone who wants to go deeper in his or her understanding of theology, the Bible, and how to study the Bible, all for the purpose of preparing you to play a key role in God's plan, using your gifts and influence to reach our city with His love. The Institute will be a hub for learning and leadership preparation for people across Greater Austin, people of all backgrounds and life stages. It's for small group leaders who want to lead better or those who aspire to serve as an elder or other leader in their church. It's for business people who desire to have greater influence in their workplace or teachers who want to reach their campuses. The Institute is just one aspect of Saturate Austin. Future plans include Saturate Austin for Church Planters and the Hispanic Leadership Institute. Find out more at saturateaustin.com. Wherever you are in life, the Saturate Austin Institute will prepare you to have the impact that you desire in your relationships, community, and wherever God leads you to serve Him in our city.
Okay, I want to talk to you about our speakers over the next 5 weeks. In addition to Pastor Tim Hawks, we'll also have Kate Hawks and also Glenn Lucky. There is a bio featured on each one of our speakers. And just so you know a little bit about each one, Kate Hawks has been educated at SMU University with a degree in history. Also at King's College in London, she has a master's degree in sociology and anthropology of religion in contemporary society. So she is well qualified to speak to us, and she'll be speaking to us on women's rights and also about slavery. Pastor Tim will be talking tonight about what Christianity believes about science and also the environment later. And then Glenn Luckey on the university. Glenn Luckey has a PhD in sociology from the University of Virginia, and he is a lead partner in the Docent Research Group that provides research for nonprofits and churches all over America. And now I want to introduce tonight's speaker, Pastor Tim Hawks. Many of you know him. Pastor Tim has been our pastor here at Hill Country for 26 years. Of note, he has degrees from Baptist Bible College and also from Dallas Theological Seminary. Pastor Tim encourages his church and his staff to use our brain as it relates to Christianity, to be learners and to develop ourselves and to dig into things and study. And also, Pastor Tim, part of this was born out of your desire. Basically, you found out that this whole myth that people believed the earth was flat 500-600 years ago was a myth, and it really sparked your curiosity to study the leading scholars in Christianity, agnosticism, and also in atheism, the leading scholars and historians. And so with that, I want to introduce Pastor Tim. I'll stop talking now, and we're glad you're here. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul. Well, welcome to the Clash. I can tell by the people that are here that this is of interest to you, and I'm very glad because it's of great interest to me. It's always important that we understand the facts and the truth as we formulate our opinions and our worldviews, our philosophy, and our religious values. And so understanding those things is very, very significant. I also recognize that the topics that we are going to be talking about in this series are just going to get you started. So I know that there are going to be some people here that say, well, what about, you want the details? And there are going to be some other people that go, don't go there. And so we're going to try to kind of find middle ground here. I would also say, whether you find yourself as a committed believer or a committed skeptic, we're glad you're here. We want you to relax, and you need to know that this is not a church service, okay? This is a lecture. In fact, what we're doing with the topics is on Sunday morning, I'm actually discussing what does the Bible say about. And so on Sunday, I talked about what does the Bible actually say about science. And so if you're interested, you can come to our media player and you can listen to that message because it actually lays it out in detail. What does the Bible say about science? Tonight, we're not talking about what the Bible says at all. What we're talking about tonight is the history of the relationship between science and the church. And so that's going to be the main focus of what we're talking about. Now, here's how this thing started. How this started for me was about 8 years ago, I picked up a book written by a sociology professor at Baylor, and I began to read the book, and when I came to the section on science, I was expecting the standard, what I'd learned my whole life, that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue and discovered that the world was round. And he was quite a gutsy fellow because everybody at the time believed that the earth was flat, propped up by the church who taught that to everybody based on the dogma of their book. Guess what I discovered? Nobody at the time of Christopher Columbus believed that the world was flat. Not one person. Nobody. That wasn't at all the belief of the day. In fact, from the 3rd century B.C., people that were educated in the world did not believe that the world was flat, dating all the way back to the Greek thinkers, Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, and people didn't believe that. In fact, in the 1000 AD period of time, the popes and the scientists that were part of the church, which, by the way, the only scientists that existed were part of the church at the time, were having conversations about the size of the earth in relationship to the other celestial beings in the universe. And the most popular textbook of the medieval period of time related to astronomy was entitled Spheres. in the Journal of Christopher Columbus, in the biography that his son wrote, there's no mention of any controversy around the flat earth. And in all the writing related to Magellan's majestic voyage around the whole globe, nobody ever mentioned anything about believing in the flat earth. In fact, let me show you. This was taken from a textbook that was published around the time of Christopher Columbus's travel, and this shows here basically an engraving of a globe. And if you look carefully at the globe, you'll see that the equator's clearly marked, that the poles are clearly marked, that the tropics are clearly marked, and everybody believed this then. And the question I wondered is, why in 1966 in Bath Elementary School, as a kindergartner, was I taught something that everybody knows that's not true? And some of you are going, you mean that's not true? If you're feeling that way, you should, because the majority of us, that's what we learned. So where did that come from? Rodney Stark, in his book, For the Glory of God, he writes this. He says, the reason we didn't know the truth concerning these matters is that the claim of an inevitable and bitter warfare between science, religion, and science has for more than three centuries been the primary polemical device used in the atheist attack on faith. From Thomas Hobbes through Carl Sagan and Richard Dawkins, false claims about religion and science have been used as a weapon in the battle to, quote, free the human mind from the fetters of faith. In other words, the ends justifies the means. That even though these things are not really historically accurate, they work really well in convincing people to shake off their archaic faith and embrace a new way of thinking, which will ultimately be best for everybody in the world. That's where the myth comes from. In fact, the person that brought the myth to America was the first president of Cornell University, who wrote a two-volume book called The History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. Andrew Dixon White, the first president of Cornell, put together this two volumes where he went through and documented all of these things in history that most of them were actually tweaked or made up to create this warfare between the church and science. And that textbook was used right up into the 60s in the United States in universities. In fact, it was just reprinted in 1997. And from time to time, when I'm reading blogs, I will see someone quote him as an expert and a source for history. Now, the reality is that nobody believes that today that spends any time in the history department, particularly medieval history. So, the myths are present. My goal today is to expose you to four myths. Now, you can do whatever you want to with them, and you may completely disagree with me, but I'm going to give you the background and a little bit of information, and I'm going to run through this very quickly. So you have the opportunity to text in your questions, and we're going to give some time to try to answer those questions at the end. So here we go. Myth number one. Throughout history, the church was opposed to science. Throughout history, the church was opposed to science. The myth goes something like this. After the fall of Rome, great learning of the past was lost, and the church took control of Europe. As the church took control, it replaced free thinking with Christian dogma and plunged the West into a period called the Dark Ages. Let me just say, if you use that in conversation with an educated person, they will tell you the Dark Ages is a myth. It never existed. That was made up. You say, whoa, you're blowing my categories. I just say this. All you have to do, just Wikipedia flat earth myth. Wikipedia Dark Ages myth. It will lay out for you what I'm saying. Like, this isn't something that's hidden from people. This is settled history today, but the majority of us have heard these things and still believe it. Now, the poster child for the myth that the church stifled science is none other than Galileo. The myth goes like this, that Galileo invented the telescope and proved that the Earth was not the center of the universe. That actually, the Earth rotated on its axis and revolved around the sun, and because of that belief, he was excommunicated by the church, because the church dogma said that's not the way it is. So let's talk about the truth of that. First thing I would say is it's true that Galileo designed the best telescope of his day. Not the first and not the only, but clearly the best one. And he actually began to observe things in the universe that led him in the direction that he was going. Positive thing. Second thing about Galileo is that he said that the Earth rotated and revolved. So the Earth rotated on its axis and revolved around the sun. That's true that he said it. The problem is that he's not the first one to say it. In fact, Copernicus said it before he was actually even born. And Copernicus put that in writing. Copernicus wasn't excommunicated, wasn't kicked out of the church. Nobody got after him. And the Copernican theory was entered into the bank of science as a possible option. Now, for those of you who would take the time to go deep into the study of history, you would find that the scholastics, those are the churchmen who made up the intelligentsia, actually were moving in this direction incrementally, inch by inch, as they moved along. So Copernicus was just taking their research a step further. Galileo came along, and he's the one who said, yes, this is true. So here's the other falsehood. It's false that it is the dogma of the church interpreting the Bible that originated the idea that the earth was the center of the universe. Remember, that idea actually came from Aristotle, and it was the best science of the day. The church was just holding to that which could actually be proven at the time. Now, here's where we run into problems. We run into problems because we look at something that is clearly true today, clearly it's been proven today, and we think anybody that lived before us was stupid if they thought something different, right? I mean, that's kind of our bias. It's kind of an American thing. We think everybody else that doesn't think the way we think, kind of dumb, okay? So let me say this to you. If I were to say to you today, I want you to go outside and stand outside and using your senses, prove to me that the earth is actually rotating on its axis and it's revolving around the sun. You'd have a hard time proving that, wouldn't you? Why? Because the earth, being 25,000 miles in circumference, if it was spinning one time a day, you would actually expect the wind to be blowing about 1,000 miles an hour, wouldn't you? You would expect that if you threw a ball up in the air, that it would land someplace behind you, right? I mean, using your rational mind and your senses, that's what you would wrestle with. In addition to that, the earth is going 66,000 miles an hour in a direction in an elliptical orbit circling the sun. And so you would expect this place not to feel stable. You would expect it to feel really topsy-turvy, like, you know, you'd be motion sickness all the time. So for the person to walk outside, in normal rational thinking, somebody would have to be able to demonstrate to them that that was not the way it actually is. You know, seeing is believing, right? And so, unless I gave you a telescope and you had time to begin to observe the movements of the heavenly bodies and you had the mathematical acumen to be able to understand what was taking place, you could not prove that the earth was not stationary and everything was revolving around it. You just couldn't do that. And so, what you have here is Aristotle put forward a scientific idea. And over the course of time, scientists were learning more, mathematics was becoming more sophisticated, the telescope was being invented, and as science began to understand more, guess what? The church adapted. In fact, when Galileo was confronted, because what he'd actually put forward is science to prove that the earth was rotating around the sun, revolving around the sun, his science was poor. And everybody looked at it and went, that doesn't prove anything. And so here's what the church said to Galileo. If you come to a place where you can demonstrate scientifically that the sun is actually the center of our solar system and the earth is rotating around it, the church will assume that any passage that makes the earth look like the center is figurative language, and we will adapt, which they did. The only problem is Galileo couldn't wait. And so he wrote a book, and he slam dunked the Pope. Essentially gave him the title of simpleton or simpatico and put the Copernican theory in the mouth of the Pope. And guess what? The Pope slam dunked him. Like, they excommunicated him, which basically meant that he had to live in a house being on the payroll of the church, taken care of by the church, allowed to write, and he did his best work after that period of time. Now, Kepler, a contemporary, actually did good science, really good science. In fact, his laws of planetary motion are still in place today. Why did Kepler not receive this kind of treatment? He didn't make the Pope mad. In fact, he was a Lutheran, so he stayed away from the Pope. In addition to that, since he didn't get excommunicated, it doesn't make for a good myth that the church had always opposed and went after scientists. And so Galileo becomes the poster child. And many of you have heard that and read that and are still looking at me like, there's no way what you can be saying is true. So let me help you out here. James Hannum, in his book, The Genesis of Science, How the Christian Middle Ages Launched a Scientific Revolution, devotes two chapters to this, and there are several biographies of Galileo that have been written in the last 50 years that also lay all of this out as well. And so you can go there, you can look at it, you can find it be very helpful to you, and so that just kind of gives you a little bit of insight. But the myth persists. Why does the myth persist? Well, take a recent article that was written in the UK Guardian by A.C. Grayling, an atheist, the author of multiple books, including this one here, The God Argument, The Case Against Religion and for Humanism. Listen to what he says in The Guardian. He says, "Such was the beginnings of Christianity. By the accident of its being the myth chosen by Constantine for his purposes, it plunged Europe into the Dark Ages for the next 1,000 years. Scarcely any literature or philosophy, and the forgetting of the arts and crafts of classic civilization before a struggle to escape the church's narrow ignorance and oppression, saw the rebirth of classical learning and its ethos of inquiry and autonomy in the Renaissance." None of what he said there is actually historically true. From the myth of Christianity to Constantine picking it, to the idea of a Dark Ages, to the fact that there wasn't significant scientific advance in art and literature and development during the Middle Ages, all of that is false. When Grayling was confronted on that, here's what he said. He said, his column was, of course, brief, conversational, rhetorical, and polemic only. So let me interpret this for you. Like, if I would have had time to explain myself, but it was brief. Conversational means I was just kind of given a little bit of an opinion here to start a conversation. Here's the two words that hurt. The word rhetorical means intending to persuade. And the word polemic means against something. So my words were intended to start a conversation using my persuasive ability against Christianity, using things that I personally know are not true. That's a problem, isn't it? That's a problem. So much so that Tim O'Neill, a medieval history professor and a member of the Atheist Society of Australia, is constantly criticizing atheists for using history incorrectly. Here's what he says. He says, in the academic sphere, at least the conflict thesis, that's the war between the church and science, the conflict thesis of history, war between science and theology, has been long since overturned. It is very odd that so many of my fellow atheists cling so desperately to a long-dead position that was only ever upheld by an amateur 19th-century polemicist and not the careful research of recent, objective, peer-reviewed historians. This is strange behavior for the people who like to label themselves as rationalists. Now, this is not a criticism per se of atheists, because there are many atheists who understand history and who promote it in a correct and proper way. And there are many people of faith that will twist facts in order to try to make their position look more tenable. I just want to make sure that we have the record straight that this whole idea, and by the way, I'm giving you a snippet, this whole idea that the church is opposed and Christianity is opposed science is insane. Science was born in the rationalism of Christianity. Science was fueled and fed by the church hiring scholars, preserving books and manuscripts, encouraging free thought and discussion, adapting and adopting these ideas as it went along. The birth of Western science, modern science today, actually found its cradle, got its training pants, and grew to adolescence in the Church of Jesus Christ. That's fact. And so, let me take you to the second myth. This is controversial, and we'll get everybody upset about this one, get them stirred up. How's that sound? Second myth is this. Christians have historically interpreted the Bible as a scientific textbook. Christians have historically interpreted the Bible as a scientific textbook. Here's how the myth works. How can you be objective when your belief in your book will always trump any discovery of science? Now, that sounds like a legitimate thing to wrestle with, right? Like if you're predisposed to always say, well, if it doesn't line up with my Bible, then it can't be true. So what really did the church do? Well, again, let me go back to Richard Dawkins, professor of public understanding of science at Oxford and an avowed atheist, writing in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, where he's not only criticizing anybody who believes intelligent design or creationism, but he's also criticizing any scientist, atheistic scientist, that has a different view of evolutionary theory than the one he holds to. And here's what he says. He says, pretend as they will to scientific credentials. The anti-evolutionist propagandists are always religiously motivated, even if they try to buy credibility by concealing the fact. In most cases, they know deep down what to believe because their parents recommended an ancient book that tells them what to believe. If the scientific evidence learned in adulthood contradicts the book, there must be something wrong with the scientific evidence. The holy book of childhood cannot be, must not be wrong. So it doesn't make any difference what your academic credentials are. It doesn't make any difference what kind of science you're doing. If you are a Christian, you will always reject anything you find going back to what he calls an ancient book, okay? And by the way, the only reason why you believe it, according to him, is because you were raised that way. Your parents taught you this, and you were raised that way. So that's the objection. That's the myth. So let's talk about it. From the early days, the church fathers began to actually address how to interpret the Bible, what is figurative and what is literal. And watch this. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, it says, God created the two great lights, one to govern the day and one to govern the night. Now, we know what those two great lights would be, right? Okay, the day, that would be the sun. The nighttime, that would be the moon, the two great lights in the heavens. The problem is, the moon does not generate light. In fact, if you go outside and you look with any level of objectivity at the sun, and then you look at the moon, you're going to see that there's quite a bit of difference between the two, right? In fact, if you put your hand up on a warm day toward the sun, you feel the heat. If you put it up at night toward the moon, you feel nothing. So, what does the church do with that? Isn't it a literal thing? The answer is the church has historically looked at that as figurative language and understood that what the Bible is talking to is individuals and their experience, not a rough, scientific, literal interpretation. In fact, the church has always done that. Let me show it to you. St. Augustine, 345 to 430, actually mimicking what others before him have said in his commentary on the book of Genesis. Here's what he says. He says, usually even a non-Christian knows something about the earth, the heavens, and the other elements of this world, about the motions and orbits of the stars, and even their sizes and relative positions. Now, it is a disgraceful and dangerous thing for an infidel, be a non-believer, to hear a Christian presumably giving the meaning of the Holy Scriptures talking nonsense on these topics. And we should take all means to prevent such an embarrassing situation in which people show up, vast ignorance in a Christian, and laugh it to scorn. In other words, we need to keep people from learning a wooden literal translation of figurative language and saying, oh, well, the moon must have its own independent light because that's what this means, right? And he's arguing, no, that's not what it means. That's what we see, but it goes no further than that. This concept of figurative language, allowing the Bible to speak in a way that is kind of normal literature for people to read, is the way the church has always interpreted the Bible. Listen to William of Conches, who in 1085 to 1154, kind of giving you the dates when he lived, he was a natural philosopher, and his greatest work was working to take Plato and correlate it to the story of creation in the book of Genesis. Here's what he says. He says, the authors of truth, that would be the writers of the Bible, are silent on matters of natural philosophy, not because these matters are against the faith, but because they have little to do with upholding of such faith, which is what those authors were concerned with. In other words, they weren't concerned with writing a scientific explanation. They were communicating things about people, about God, and using the world to illustrate those things. This has been the position of the church all along. In fact, Galileo warned the church because what he could see through his telescope seemed to be indicating, even though he couldn't prove it, that Copernicus was right. And it wasn't out of hate for the church, but it was out of loyalty that he told the leaders of the church, guys, if you stick with the old Aristotelian view of cosmology, you're going to be embarrassed. Little did he know that that embarrassment would carry right to 2015 in Austin, Texas, where we're talking about it today, where the church actually wouldn't make that move until just a couple years later, when it was actually identifiably proven and they understood the figurative language. So, let me get us into some hot water here. How does that sound? So, how does the church interpret Genesis chapter 1? The 6 days of creation. Let me see if I can make you all mad. There are three prevailing views that are held widely in the church today. The first view is this, that the earth and all of life was created about 6 to 10,000 years ago in six 24-hour days. That's one of the views. That view is the view that has the most conflict with current scientific understanding. And it's also the view that is only quoted by the anti-church people when they talk about what church people believe. That's the only view that's quoted. And so when you read Dawkins, that's what you hear from him, is everybody believes that the earth is only this age. In fact, some of you in the room may have walked away from the faith because you think that that's the only way to interpret the first chapter of Genesis. But before you get too nervous, let me just say a couple things. There are people that have legitimate degrees that are doing legitimate science. And they, though their science is in the minority, have some reasons to believe that this could be true. And if you've never read why they believe that, it's not simply because it's their faith. There actually is science. And it would be inappropriate for anybody to dismiss that and call it non-scientific unless you actually took the time to look at their science. Because there's some really interesting things that could have happened over the last 10,000 years in the history of the world that would actually make this a possible explanation. There's also some really interesting things about science. You know, we know science is a moving target, don't we? In fact, every good scientist would say, I'm hoping that we learn more. Could it be that we don't know everything that there is to know yet? That maybe the young earth creationists are actually the Galileos of today? Could it be that? I'm just saying this is one possible position on Genesis chapter 1. In order to illustrate that, I want to show you two guys. Oop, going the wrong way. Let's go this way. You guys recognize these people? Anybody recognize these people? You recognize one of them, don't you? There's Albert Einstein. You don't recognize the other one, do you? Father George Lemaître? Which one of these two guys supported, actually even developed, the idea of the Big Bang and the expanding universe, and which one of these two opposed it? You guys know I wouldn't put this up here if you... So Lemaître is a Belgian priest who's also an astronomer and teaches physics at one of the Catholic universities in Belgium. And he looks at Einstein's work on general relativity and sees that Einstein has established a reasonable explanation for general relativity and the rules pertaining to gravity, but because Einstein is so committed to the common belief at the time that was kind of a steady state, matter has always existed, he was actually tweaking his equations to prove what was already considered settled science at the time. And Lemaître kept coming in and saying, no, there's a better explanation. It's called the Big Bang. It's called this little particle where it all started, where matter was all condensed together. And he would go from place to place talking to people. And you've got to believe that there were some scientists that said, oh, he's a Catholic priest. What in the thunder does he know about anything? But the majority of the people in this room today would say, anybody that doesn't embrace the concept of the expanding universe is way backwards. One thing I like about this picture is these two guys look like they're getting along, don't they? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great if we lived in a world where everybody wasn't trying to make everybody else that doesn't think exactly the way that they are shout them down? Call them names, treat them badly? Okay, getting off track here. So let me also just go on to show you a couple other things. Oh, let me wait, I'll hold off on that. Getting ahead of myself. So, second interpretation of Genesis chapter 1 is it's all figurative. That there's nothing scientific in it at all. That what it's intended to do is teach a theology about God. So on the first 3 days, God creates order because God is a God of order. On the second 3 days, God actually creates fullness. He fills everything. And it's just laid out there to kind of give you an understanding that God is a God of order and fullness. And using the creation account kind of just display this. The third view that's prevalent among Christians today is the view that God actually caused the Big Bang and then guided the process, including the development of life, which would be evolution. So those people would fit very neatly into an old earth model, and they do a great job of explaining first cause, like where did everything come from? And it's also very satisfactory to them to be able to explain the gaps in the evolutionary process, which, by the way, no Darwinian person that believes that has actually been able to satisfactorily explain that, no matter how loud Richard Dawkins shouts that he has. And so that's the third possible view there. So when it comes to the understanding of how Genesis fits in with beginnings, the church is not unified on this. There are people that have all kinds of different ideas and that are wrestling with this. And so the idea that if you're a person of faith, you can't be a person of science, you can't take different points of view, you can't think, you can't wrestle with things, that is a myth. That's not true. Let me just give you one example. The example here is Francis Collins. Francis Collins was an avowed atheist, raised that way, believed that way, thought that way. He's a physician and a geneticist. He was actually kind of won his recognition working on the Human Genome Project, and today he's the head of the National Health Organization. He started studying the universe and came to the conclusion that there was a God, and it was harder to believe that all of this came about by chance than that it came about by a guide. He worked his way backwards into history to understand and believe that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. The evidence there is overwhelming. And he converted to Christianity. And he writes a book called The Language of God, which I would recommend all of you to read. You may not agree with every aspect of science. No scientist agrees with each other anyway, which is fine. That's part of it, right? But I would encourage you to take a look at a guy like that. This myth that people go from faith to no faith. There are a lot of people that are going from no faith to faith all the time, and many of them are coming there in science. Probably didn't know that the Vatican had an observatory, did you? In fact, they have two of them. Wonder why. Maybe they're interested in science. You probably didn't know that they had an Academy of Sciences where they're training some of their best minds in scientific studies. Nobody probably ever told you that before. But that's the nature of historical faith in Christianity. Okay, myth number three. If I haven't got myself in trouble yet, let me do it here. Okay, myth number three. Science developed equally in all civilizations. Now here, you might hang on to your chair just a little bit here. Keep yourself here to hear the whole explanation. Science developed equally in all civilizations. In 1925, the great philosopher and mathematician Alfred North Whitehead broke ranks with his atheist co-author Bertrand Russell. They had co-authored one of the greatest books on math together. He broke ranks and pronounced that science developed in Europe because of the faith in the possibility of science, which was derived directly from Christian medieval theology. In other words, he's saying, we're standing here, speaking in London, the Royal Society, we're standing here as scientists because of Christianity. And that's the history of the West. Watch what he says in his book, Science in the Modern World. When we compare this tone of thought in Europe with the attitudes of other civilizations when left to themselves, there seems to be but one source of its origin. It must come from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God, conceived as with the personal energy of Jehovah, that would be the God of the Old Testament, and with the rationality of a Greek philosopher. That's the New Testament. Every detail was supervised and ordered. The search into nature could only result in the vindication of the faith in rationality. Remember that I am not talking about the explicit beliefs of a few individuals. Like there wasn't a few individuals within Christendom that held to this. He says, what I mean is the impress on the European mind arising from the unquestioned faith of the centuries. By this I mean the instinctive tone of thought and not a mere creed of words. They didn't just take the words of Scripture, but they actually incorporated it into their rational thought, which laid the foundation of the development of modern science, which changed the Western world. Some of you may not be comfortable with this conversation because we live in a world of multiculturalism. Now, the benefit of multiculturalism is obvious. In a multicultural world, we want to bring out the achievements of every civilization because it's valuable, being part of the human family, to take a look at the whole and look at all the achievements that every group has achieved. The negativity or the downside of multiculturalism is the belief that if along the way we determine that one group had a better ideology and out of that ideology created a better civilization and society, that that group in and of itself will assume that it is superior and therefore justify subjugating the rest of the world. Now, that fear that drives multiculturalism is so palpable in our world today that when Yale University was offered $20 million simply to reinstate the course, the history of Western civilization, they turned it down. In other words, what I'm talking about right now, that's not being taught anywhere. In fact, the University of Texas criticized it as kind of the white man's hegemony and his excuse for taking over the rest of the world. So the idea of our history of how we got here has been changed and lost. We'll talk a little bit about that when Glenn does his lecture on the university. Like, how can things that are so clearly true in history be so clearly mixed up and changed in the teaching? Well, when we talk about what the university model is, you're going to get an understanding of where that came from and German Reconstructionism of the 30s and all that. Anyway, that's for another lecture. Hopefully I didn't bore you with that so you don't want to come back. But let me just say this. Christian theology teaches that you cannot discriminate against other humans. We will talk about that next week in the lecture on slavery and the role of Christianity in that whole discussion. And so it's not a Christian idea that if you identify a benefit in one group of people that comes out of good thinking, that therefore that group of people will automatically look down on others. In fact, that idea would come more quickly out of the Darwinian concept of survival of the fittest than it would out of Christian teaching. Okay? Having said that, let me go really quickly. Let me give you two examples. So let's look at China. The modern atheist Bertrand Russell was puzzled by China's lack of scientific development. Since they had no Christian impediment holding science back, according to him, science and technology should have exploded in China. The problem was that in Chinese thought, there was no God, so to speak. There was only the Tao, the essence. And the universe had always existed and always would. And so the scholars, intelligent people, sought not to understand the universe. Why would you insult it by trying to understand it? It just is. But to be enlightened personally. And so that led to a lot of really cool things that they found and discovered over the years, but never put into implementation. Let me give you an example of that. In 1405, Chinese Admiral Zheng He put together a flotilla of ships, and they sailed all the way from China past India to Africa, where they found all kinds of exotic things. They brought it back. They made seven trips with several hundred ships. The European sailors at the time began to report that they had never seen anything like these ships before. Their size, their speed, superior to anything that they had ever seen. They brought back exotic animals. They started a zoo there in China. But after the admiral died, the mandarins began to tell the ruling family that this was not good for China. That in our Confucian thinking, the outside world will only mess up the harmony of our world. And so they stripped the lumber off the ships and let them rot there in the harbor. They destroyed the plans for the ships, and they made it a capital crime to build any sailing vessel over the size of a junk, because we don't want any Western influence. That's just one example. There are many more. How about in Islam? Islam's a very interesting discussion, because as soon as Muhammad united the various tribes, they began immediately to take over the world, and they took over a big chunk of it. And so they had access to knowledge from other people. In fact, they had all of the Greek knowledge that they incorporated, and they developed some really interesting things. For example, if every day you have to pray five times to Allah, and you have to pray facing Mecca, and now you're in Spain because you just took over that territory, how does the average person figure out which way to point? And so they developed some mathematical formulas, looked at the stars, trying to figure all that out. But once they figured out their plan, it didn't go beyond that. They weren't looking for more, because their view of Allah is that our goal is not to understand him, it's to submit to him. Islam means submission. And so trying to figure out his business is actually a bit blasphemous. And so we don't see the development beyond a few ideas along the way. Devout Muslim historian Caesar Fair explains it this way. He says, the early Muslim thinkers took up philosophy where the Greeks left off. Thus in Aristotle, Muslim thinkers found the great guide to them. He became the first teacher. Having accepted this a priori, that Aristotle was their first teacher, Muslim philosophy, as it evolved in subsequent centuries, merely chose to continue in this vein and to enlarge Aristotle rather than to innovate. It chose the course of eclecticism, seeking to assimilate rather than generate, with a conscious striving to adapt the results of Greek thinking to the Muslim philosophical conceptions, but with much greater comprehension than was achieved by the early Christian dogmatics. In other words, they took Aristotle's ideas and went as far as they could, but they weren't planning to ever go beyond that. In 1485, the Sultan of the Ottoman Turk Empire outlawed the printing press, and it was outlawed for 300 years. Now, why would you outlaw the printing press? Well, if it was good enough for Muhammad, and it was good enough for Aristotle, if you read the hadiths, you'll see that that's what was discussed, then why would we want a different way of writing than the old-fashioned way? Scribes doing it by hand. Scribes doing it by hand, to which Robert Riley points out in his book, The Closing of the Muslim Mind, the Arab world stands near the very bottom of every measure of human development. Scientific inquiry is nearly moribund in the Islamic world. Spain translates more books in a single year than the entire Arab world has done in the past 1,000 years. Now, that's not a criticism of the intelligence of the people. That is the result of applied theology. So Christianity, rather than holding the world back, has taken it forward in major strides. And for those of you who have deep understanding in the multicultural way of thinking, that sounds really harsh. But reality is reality. We do much better if we work within the historical framework of truth that's laid out there. One more myth. Final myth is this, that science can explain everything. The science can explain everything. Now, let me expose this real quickly. Since science uses a method of experimentation, observation, and trying to discover objective facts about the physical world, that sounds like the right way to do things, doesn't it? I mean, to think that you would use your reason, that you would do empirical research, that you would make a thesis or a theory, that you would then test it and test it and test it to prove that it's right, and you could touch it, feel it, smell it, taste it, see it, unless you're talking about physics, and then You know, it just seems like that would be the best approach to everything. The problem is you can't do scientific method on every form of knowledge. It's absolutely impossible. In fact, to insist that you can is in itself a metaphysical statement. It is a belief or a religion to say that science has got the answer to everything. Are we saying there is nothing that we learn from art? There's nothing we learn from literature? There's nothing that we learn from sociology? There's nothing that we learn from love or human relationships that we would say there's nothing that we can learn from human government, civics, law, economics? There's nothing to be learned from any of those things? Science is the only place where knowledge is actually kept? I mean, take civics as an example. Human government, socialism, communism, fascism, anarchy, democracy, all ideas about how humans may or may not work best together. And we have a document here in the United States. You recognize that document? One of the statements in that document says this: we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Now, can you prove that scientifically? In fact, if we were to lay all of our genetics out here, we would probably find out that some of us are just a little bit better endowed than some other ones in all kinds of different areas, right? You can't prove that. But think of what your world would be like if we did not in the West believe that to be true. What would life be like if that was not true? Well, so you say, how do you prove that it's true? Well, you've got to work outside of observation, repeatability, scientific laboratory. You can't cut that up in the laboratory and study it. It's something beyond that. So here's how I want to conclude. By the way, we'll talk about where that idea came from next week when we talk about slavery. Here's how I want to conclude. Intelligent people prevail by pushing back against all agenda-laden myths. Whether they come from faith groups or whether they come from science or history, all agenda-laden myths that are not seeking truth. Science is wonderful. It opens our understanding to the physical world. If I got a brain tumor, I want science, right? But so is philosophy, art, sociology, the humanities. Those open our understanding to the human experience. And when it comes to religion, that opens our understanding to our connection with the divine. Now, answer this question. Wouldn't you be a more open-minded person if you were drawing truth from all of those disciplines and spheres than if you only chose to narrow it to science and say that's all that matters? In other words, what I'm arguing for is that we as people learn how to dialogue, debate, disagree, interact, and in the course of doing that, seek truth and learn to get along and love each other in the process. So everybody that thinks different than you is not the enemy, and we don't have to make stuff up to try to make it be that. The Christian church, rather than being the antithesis of science, has been the birthplace and the incubator and the support of science. It is a holy calling. And there is no conflict between Christianity and science. They go hand in glove. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Pastor Tim. Very enlightening and thought-provoking. At this time, we're going to transition from the lecture to our actual question and answer time. I'm going to invite next week's speaker, Kate Hawks, up at this time. And as they're getting ready back there, I want to remind you that if you have not texted or tweeted your questions in, you can still do that. Also, out at Brushy Creek and Steiner Ranch, we're so glad you guys are with us. You guys, too, please text in your questions at this time. And we're going to have a time of Q&A moderated by Pastor Tim and Kate Hawks.
Hello.
Okay, Kate, lay it out there for me.
Okay,
I get to do this to you next week, so.
I'm going to warm you up with an easy question.
Okay, very good.
Well, we'll see how easy this is, if I can find it. There are lots of questions. Okay. Bear with me as I scroll. Where is it? Okay. This person wants to know, where can we find these sources that you've been talking about? They were kind of going really quickly on the screen, so are we going to be able to see them? And do we have any sources that were before? I thought that was probably going to be easy.
So here's what I want to say. Here's the challenge. What takes place is people put forward an idea. Early 1900s, there was a group of people that said all of these things about the conflict between Christianity. And immediately, the scholars went back and started reading the actual documents from the medieval period, pulling them out of the monasteries and beginning to read them. And for the next 50 years or so, they began to write books and kind of explain why all of these myths were not true. In fact, there's about four books that were written in the 90s on the flat earth myth. The problem with that is they're written about specific situations. And so, you know, you can pick up multiple books on Galileo and find out exactly what happened. You can actually read the documents of what the church wrote and what was going on at the time. But who wants to read a 600-page book on Galileo when you're really looking for an overview? So there aren't that many books that give you an overview. So here's the place to start. Rodney Stark is an outstanding sociologist at Baylor University. We tried to get him to speak, come here and speak, but he said, no, he just writes. And then when we heard one of his lectures, we thought, probably better that he just keeps writing. If you want a crash course in Western civilization, his book with the tongue-in-cheek title, How the West Won, will lay out information that will blow your mind. In science, James Hannum is a great overview. And as you read through that, look at his sources. And if you want to go deeper into those sources, that's great. I would encourage you to do that. Alvin Schmidt, How Christianity Changed the World. It's a little bit, because he was a Lutheran pastor and a sociology professor. Some of you may feel it's a little churchy for you, but his information is documented well. That's a good one for you to read. And then if you just are a literature buff and you want to look at the power of myth, I mean, you kind of like to understand literature and how that works. This book by Philip Sampson, Six Modern Myths About Christianity and Western Civilization, really good overview about six things that people believe that are just not true. So, anyway, that's my short answer.
Okay.
I spent way too much time reading, so I'm sorry.
Okay, second question. If the church and historians of today knew that the masses were being taught incorrect history in school, then why hasn't the church fought to change the curriculum, do you think? For example, another person asked, recently they were taught in a world history class about the Dark Ages. So why do you think that those myths are being perpetuated if history is showing that they're not true?
That's a really, really good question. The first thing I would say to that is I think most of us still think these myths are true. And so going after the people who are teaching them are not stuff that we're going to do because we still think that they're true. The bigger question to me is, why are the academics not policing each other? And we'll talk about that when we talk about the university. That's the bigger question. I was on a plane last week and sitting next to two college-age students, and when I was reading one of my books and they started asking questions, and both of them had been taught all these myths, and they're 19 years old. So it's still being perpetuated in the world, and it actually fits a scenario. The general feel in the world is that religion is bad, and so these myths keep getting perpetuated. And frankly, let me just, for all you guys who have Catholic backgrounds, let me just apologize for some of the negative rhetoric during the Reformation against the Catholic Church. It had its problems. Protestant churches had its problems, but the Catholic Church at least was organized to address some of these things in the past. And I would say that the Protestant church is just, like, there's no organization that we really have to do it. And everything then turns into a political battle. I don't know if anybody notices that or if it's just me. But a lot of people just want to stay away from it because the name-calling and the vilialetry that comes your way when you just simply stand up and say that's not right. And a lot of times we just kind of want to go back and So anyway, you have anything to add? You've been in the academic world.
I'm just going to keep asking questions.
Okay.
This is your turn. Actually, there is a question for me. Kate, are you Tim's daughter or granddaughter? I wanted to throw that. I'll leave that open for interpretation. Okay, moving quickly along.
I think I know who said that.
Okay, we talked a couple times about taking things in the Bible figuratively or literally. Who decides what we take figuratively and literally, and how do you even tackle that?
That is an absolute great question, and oftentimes people feel like interpretation of literature or biblical interpretation are not parallel to each other. But in the same way that you would read a history book and be able to kind of determine by looking at the grammar, the syntax, the context, you would pretty clearly understand what figurative and what's literal, right? So if you said her cheeks are like roses, nobody puts a rose petal on a person's cheek, right? You know what that means. And so there is a whole system that we call hermeneutics that, by the way, we're going to be teaching in our Saturate Austin Institute to ensure that when you're looking at a passage or when you're looking at the whole chapter, you can understand the rules of grammar, the rules of syntax, the rules of context, the rules of culture, and apply those to have some level of confidence that what you're getting interpretation-wise is actually what the original author meant to say when they wrote it. Now, it's not 100% sure, and that's why, you know, we've got Methodists and Presbyterians and Catholics and Baptists. Unfortunately, they're not all Bible church people because, you know, we probably have it all figured out, right? Just like Kate's my granddaughter, right? But there is a whole system of interpretation, and let's write this down. We'll post a link to a book on hermeneutics for those of you who guys want to go further. So somebody make a note of that, and we'll get that up for you.
Okay, next question. I like this question because I think that probably a lot of people are thinking this. Mm-hmm. This one says, my experience from the 60s to the present of evangelicalism has been largely indifference or hostility toward thought and study. Is this experience atypical? And if so, then why do so many people feel that?
That's a great question. So I just read a statistic that a major study was done on people of faith and their views of science. And evangelicalism has the highest appreciation that science and Christianity can find common ground. So of all of the different approaches to faith, the stream of evangelicalism, which is the most common today in America, has a high confidence that faith and science can work together, much lower in other sectors of Christendom and Christianity. I do think that we have developed a view in the world that if you don't have a PhD behind your name, you really can't speak to something. And the entertainment culture fits into that nicely because you can say, since I can't know, where's the switcher? Let me turn on my channels and just veg out with my free time because I don't have a degree in this. And we've moved into a world or a culture where advanced degrees make you right. I'm always fascinated by who gets to say what and why. Some of you may be thinking, well, just because you're the pastor, why do you get to speak to this? I don't know. This is the world we live in. But when Hollywood people are testifying before Congress, like what? Like what? So anyway, I think part of that's just, I don't know if I'm answering the question, but we got a weird cultural thing that we leave high levels of intelligence to the experts, and if we don't have the knowledge, we don't pay attention to it. And I'm arguing really hard that everybody engages their brain. I think the reason why the flat earth myth still exists is because we don't read, we don't think, we don't study, and that needs a change.
Next question. Do you have any recommendations on how people who strongly disagree on topics like this can pursue truth together?
Absolutely. I think it's real important that people learn to actually have a conversation and put their emotions aside, where you stop and you listen to the other person to fully understand their point of view. One of the things I found frequently is in the process of somebody expressing their point of view, they realize that they're self-contradicting. And so rather than having to try to argue, you just listen and people will talk themselves through. At the same time, I also realize that sometimes when I'm in the middle of a conversation that I'm self-contradicting. And so being able to say that having a conversation where I listen is the most significant thing. And whether you're coming from an atheist perspective and you believe that your goal in life is to help people become skeptics, or whether you're coming from a faith perspective and your goal in life is to convince people to become Christians, you influence people by getting close to them, not by standing back and yelling at them. And so therefore, if you want to win the day, you've got to build a relationship. Listen, have a conversation. And for people of faith, if you believe that science is going to find something that will undermine your faith, then you don't have a whole lot of faith, right? For those of you who are worried that if somebody puts forward a faith argument, it will undermine your skepticism, then your skepticism isn't very good. So let's come together and talk.
How do you respond that modern science flows from Greek learning and not so much the early church?
So that is the myth that the guys in the early 1900s wrote. What they basically said, and this is what A.C. Grayling says, it repeats over and over again, that after the fall of the Roman Empire, all of the Greek learning was lost. Excuse me. And the barbarian tribes of Europe just, you know, lived in this backwards barbarism, and then the priest came in and converted them and taught them dogma, and that was life for 1,000 years. That's what, and so during the Renaissance, they rediscovered Greek stuff, and that's when all this thing blossomed. If you read the skeptics' blogs, you read the atheist blogs, that's exactly what they'll tell you. None of it is actually true. Well, I gave my book away, so let me go back. The book on science here, and actually, like all the Rodney Stark books, will walk you through literally hundreds of names of thinkers and specific scientific developments that took place during that period of time that was called the Dark Ages. You will find archaeological evidence that the people of Europe were actually taller during the Dark Ages because of their superior diet when they developed the plow than they were later on in the Renaissance period in the overcrowded cities. So all kinds of evidence to prove that that's wrong. And the Apostle Paul, 17 years after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, is standing on Mars Hill where the Greek scholars argued. Do you think that the church didn't know about Greek thought? So anyway, that is the myth. So I would encourage you, read these guys. Particularly read James Hammond, the Genesis of Science. And then there's a chapter in For the Glory of God, How Monotheism, I love this title, How Monotheism Led to Reformation Science, Witch Hunts, and the End of Slavery. Really interesting study, so I'd encourage you to read those. And then, follow the foot. If you don't believe these guys, follow the footnotes. They'll take you there. Okay.
What evolutionary gaps that you mentioned are present in tangible physical evidence that we have on record?
So I don't believe that I need to be the one who walks us through that because I'm actually not a biologist, but there are multiple places where there are big questions of how did we get from one species to another, and we'll post something about that for you to look at, okay?
Can we also post something, maybe, about the scientists that put forth a plausible young Earth view?
A what?
A plausible young Earth view.
Yeah, I probably don't want to go into that either.
We can post it, is what I'm saying.
We can post something on there. We can send you to some of their stuff. Just some really strange stuff, like there's a canopy theory that the early Earth had a cloud canopy that was broken up at the time of the flood, which would explain why we have mastodons in the Arctic. Because right now, unless there was significant global warming in the prehistoric days, how did vegetation and Oil? Like, why would you have oil in Alaska? So anyway, there's some reasons why people wrestle with some of those things, and there are other answers too, but we'll post something about that. Hope somebody's making a list. You guys making a list? Okay, good. Okay.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. Let's give them one more big hand. They would love to stay and answer questions all night, but we want to respect your time also. And so before you're dismissed tonight, if we could just go over a couple of things with you guys. First of all, we appreciate all the questions. They're really good questions, and we'll take some more next week. Pastor Tim and Kate will be down front if you'd like to talk to them. Also out at our other locations, Pastor Don is there. Pastor Jason is there for your questions. Also, as I mentioned earlier, the lecture series is sponsored by Saturate Austin. And so if you'd like more information on that, you can actually fill that out. Sorry, I'm going to shuffle my notes here. On this handout that had our speaker bios, and you could actually fill out and we'll contact you, get you more information about that. We're looking for some good folks to be part of Saturate Austin. Also, we're going to have coffee available down here in the lobby. We'd like you guys to continue your conversations. And next week, Kate will be here talking to us about the myths surrounding slavery. You do not want to miss it. We want to see you back. And so we'll see you back here next week. Have a great night and a great week. Thanks for being here.